You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. When you think about all that you care about when it comes to your daily life, feeling safe probably ranks pretty high. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety is a section of state government that includes a wide range of duties. Under this umbrella, you'll find the State Patrol, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, the Fire Marshal Division, and Driver and Vehicle Services. All of the leaders of those divisions report to the Public Safety Commissioner. Now, I find myself asking who would want such a job and who could possibly be qualified to fill it? Well, Governor Tim Walz decided it is John Harrington. After decades of working with the St. Paul Police Department, he became the St. Paul Police Chief in 2004. He left that job to run for office and in 2010 was elected to serve in the state Senate. A couple of years later, he became the police chief of Metro Transit, the public bus and light rail train system in the Twin Cities. Now, through it all, Harrington was teaching classes at Metro State University and the University of St. Thomas and learning about the world around him as a student himself. He traveled to Somalia to get a better understanding of the culture there to better serve the community here. Today, John Harrington is here with me at NPR News to tell us more about his experience and what he sees as priorities for making Minnesota safer for all of us. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Angela. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And I get the impression that you like to stay busy, that you enjoy a challenge, and I think maybe you have met your match with this new job.
I don't know if I've met my match, but it is, I like solving problems. I like solving puzzles, and I think that's what drew me to police work originally, and it's what keeps me going every day, is every day there's a new challenge. It's very difficult to stagnate in police work to begin with. And the Department of Public Safety, because it is so broad and has such a number of different mandates, you will never be bored there. I can promise that.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about tackling some of those problems today. But I see a smile on your face. This is truly appealing to you, being put in a position where you can find solutions.
Governor Walz gave me an opportunity. If you think about my career, I started out as a beat cop on the east side. So I started out walking Payne Avenue and then moved into running the Western District with Frogtown, Summit U, Highland Park. And that was a bigger place to work in. And then took on the city of St. Paul in its entirety and then moved from there to an 8-county metro region with 90 cities. And now this is really the pinnacle of my career. This is an opportunity to try and help craft public safety on a statewide basis, from Duluth to Worthington, from the South Dakota borders all the way to Hudson and back. I want to make sure that Minnesotans are safe. And I want to make sure that we can really live up to that dictum that Governor Walz has given us to say, we're all about making this one Minnesota.
So when we look at this wide range of responsibilities, what do you see as your priorities?
Well, since I've gotten here, I will tell you that it's Min Lars in the morning, it's Min Lars in the afternoon, it's Min Lars Min Lars late at night. So trying to fix the Min Lars system, and it's actually multiple systems, is certainly one of the major priorities that the governor has given me. He has been very clear to me that when he appointed me to this position, he made it clear, abundant and clear, that the Department of Public Safety is the repository for the driver and vehicle services system. And as such, we take personal responsibility for making sure that Min Lars works, that we've had in the past get fixed, and that we continue to serve the people of Minnesota. And that's certainly a major priority. But I'll be honest, I've got a much broader policy agenda that I want to see us do. I want to start working on domestic violence statewide. I want to make sure that victims of crime have the kind of services, no matter how small the town they live in or how big the city they live in. I want to make sure that women and children are protected. I want to make sure that as we look at the state highways, and it's been a sobering experience this last few weeks, we've had 7 to 8 different troopers' cars crashed into with the black ice and all the snow.
I saw photos that the State Patrol posted of all their vehicles that were hit.
I've got troopers getting injured, and at the same time that we have that, I'm working with the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that motorists trapped out on the highway can have a refuge in Olivia, and that we can get the National Guard to where they need to be, and involved in conversations about how do we tackle this issue of what are we doing with the homeless. So it is a broad portfolio of duties, and I'm just completely excited about the idea of tackling them all.
All right, you're still smiling. We're going to talk again in a year and we'll see where you're at. But
how much grayer do you think I can get at this point? So
I want to dig a little deeper into MNLARS so that our listeners really understand the background of this. So Department of Public Safety oversees driver and vehicle services. And MNLARS is that computer system that is used by driver and vehicle services. It's been plagued with problems since it was launched a couple of years ago. People experienced lots of delays and mistakes as they were trying to get their driver's licenses and vehicle registrations and titles. And just this morning, I think it was just after 9 this morning, the Officer of Legislative Auditor, that office released a report on what went wrong with MNLARS. And in short, you know, it was like a 90-page document, but it stated that there were some technical problems, but also a lack of oversight by leaders in the Department of Public Safety at the time, as well as the Office of Minnesota Information Technology Services. So, you know, what can you tell me about what you want to see happen and how do we get there? It sounds like you're still digging yourself into the background of what happened.
The devil's in the details, but I would say I'm not at the infancy of figuring this out. And the OLA's report has been really instructive because it really talks about the MNLARS project started in 2007. This is a Tim Pawlenty governor's initiative. And so it's been going on for 11 years. It's gone through a couple different governors and several different commissioners. And it is not just one system. It is your driver's license system. It was 8 different legacy systems. So all of those systems have to work together. And what I've learned about that is 2 things. One, you have to have somebody that's in charge. And so what we have made, as I said, Governor Walz has made this clear. The Department of Public Safety is the entity. It is the department. And I am the commissioner who has to make sure that this works. And I own that. And I feel very similar to, you know, when I worked as a chief in St. Paul. The mayor gives you the job that says you're going to protect the citizens of St. Paul. That's your responsibility, and you have to own that responsibility. I own the responsibility to make as we move forward on MNLARS. But it's MNLARS and DVS.
Yeah, and you won't be alone because the governor is trying to hire a commissioner to oversee the Minnesota Information and Technology Services office.
And I can't wait to get a partner to hold hands as we walk into this together, because it is really going to be a partnership. But even while it's a partnership, MNIT serves DPS. So MNIT, DPS is the client that is running and responsible. And MNIT is the technology and the subject matter experts who are going to build the computer systems to make sure that we are able to deliver to Minnesota's world-class service in their driver's license and their title services.
Are you an IT dude in your personal life?
I can operate an iPhone, I guess. But when I was at St. Paul Police Department, we had to go from a paper system. Back in my day, that's how we wrote things on our hands and in notebooks. And we went from that to Packet Writer, which was a very robust records management system. That was a change. We went from people using punch cards up in the comm center, and I can still remember we had a little conveyor belt. That's how the cards would go to the dispatcher, to computer-aided dispatch. That was a change in system. And then when we went to the county system, that was an even bigger system. I've done system change with IT before. I did the same thing at Transit. We had LETG, which was a small records management system. And as the department grew from 60 full-time cops to 140 cops, and as we continued to grow our base from 20,000 calls a year to over 70,000 calls a year, that system wasn't adequate for us anymore. And so we built new systems that were robust enough to handle an 8-county, 90-city load. MNLARS is a different challenge because it's 87 counties. It's the entire state of Minnesota, and it impacts everybody that lives in Minnesota. Everybody that drives has to interact with. Everybody that has a car or a boat or a trailer has to interact with the system, and we've got to get it right.
So on to another topic that is a big news story today as well, school shootings and protecting students. Very much on the minds of many people today on the anniversary of the Parkland, Florida high school shooting 1 year ago. So what are your thoughts about what can be done to prepare schools in Minnesota for the possibility of an active shooter? You know, what role can law enforcement play to keep schools safe and prevent a mass shooting from happening?
Well, I happened to serve as a juvenile officer in St. Paul PD, and I was the person who helped design the school resource officer system for St. Paul. So we went from one cop in a school to having cops in all of the junior highs and all of the senior highs. And we recognized that part of having those cops in the schools was creating a relationship with the students in the schools, their parents, and with the school officials. Because we were doing that, I think that made the school safer. Now, one of those, I know you saw the org chart, which has got a lot of different boxes on it. One of the boxes on that org chart is the school safety operation. We're an advisory group that provides technical expertise to schools all over the state of Minnesota about how can they make their schools safer. And so I see my role as the Commissioner of Public Safety really being twofold. One, expanding the reach of the school safety staff so that schools, when they have a threat, can very quickly access our expertise to get ahead of this. But just as importantly, before there's a threat, I want my staff to be out there helping them provide prevention activities. How should we screen for this? How can you? And I don't think schools need to be prisons. I mean, I've seen some designs of schools that they're safe. But I don't know that any learning is going to go on in them because they're constructed really to make sure that nothing bad from the outside could get in. That, to me, isn't a school. A school is a place where learning takes place, where kids can be creative, and where their energy can flow. The school safety department understands that vision, and I think that's one of the ways that at the Department of Public Safety, we're going to be able to help school districts all over the state. And in addition to that, I will finally add, we have created linkages and partnerships between the local police, the local schools, and BCA and other agencies. And so by facilitating those partnerships, we can get ahead of cases. We've had one most recently where there was a threat of a school shooting that came up. The BCA tracked it down. They were able to track down two schools in the state of Minnesota that had the name of the school that was on an internet chat line. They were able to identify that there was, in fact, a young person there who fit the description from the internet profile. We were able to work with the FBI and with local police to make sure that he and his parents got the services they needed so that his mental health issues could be addressed. And by having them addressed, no one was hurt. No one was injured, and nobody really, the threat was something we knew about. But frankly, other than the school officials, I don't think any of the students in that school knew just how dire that threat was.
Do you think that the lockdowns and the drills, the safety drills that schools do, there are many parents who don't like that, who think that it causes more problems or creates anxiety? Do you feel that they're helpful to go through those safety drills?
I do think you and I are of that age when we remember fire drills, and You do what you practice. If you don't practice those drills, my fear is that in a case of an emergency, people will not respond in a way that makes them more safe. And what we want is we want the young people in that building to understand that we are there for their safety, but they can do a ton to make sure that they're safe also.
If you're just joining us, we want to let you know that we are talking to the newly appointed Public Safety Commissioner for the state of Minnesota, John Harrington, and we'd love to take your calls. What do you think should be one of his priorities as he takes over the top spot in overseeing all of these departments that deal with safety in Minnesota? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000 or leave me a message on Twitter. Let's talk about your most recent job. You were the Metro Transit Police Chief from 2012 to 2019. And I know one of the highlights of your career there was diversifying the staff. And I hope this number is correct, because it seems pretty amazing that you took the department's diversity from 5 to 50%.
That's correct. It's a 500% increase in diversity. And I think when I got there, I was the third black officer on the department. When I left, there were, I think, around 30.
So how did you go about hiring all of these people?
my nickname used to be the pirate. So I did go out and I did. There are a few sheriff's departments that had some very talented corrections officers that I don't think they understood just how good they were.
You stole good employees.
I stole great employees and said, if you come with me, we're going to create a department where we can be of service to not just a very limited population, but to a very broad population and where your skills will be appreciated. One of the things that I did there and that I'm planning to do at Department of Public Safety is I emphasize being multilingual and multicultural. I really do believe that you don't get a second chance to make that good first impression. And you don't get a second chance to understand the needs of a person who doesn't speak English as a first language when they're in crisis. By hiring people that had multiple languages, and I, Kadra Muhammad, who speaks like five languages, and Soto Mayabaca, who speaks two or three different Spanish dialects, they were able to hit the ground in a way that said when they heard somebody in crisis, they could respond immediately. And they could respond in an empathetic and an effective manner. And so we're already starting to have that conversation with State Patrol and BCA and all the other services we provide to make sure that in the state of Minnesota, that once again, that one Minnesota idea, everybody needs to be at the table. And so we're going to be doing lots of community outreach and lots of inclusion activities to make sure that folks in Minnesota feel like this is their Department of Public Safety.
And I saw in your background, you grew up in Chicago, you went to Dartmouth College, but you majored in religion and minored in Chinese. So learning other languages, you've seen firsthand the benefit of that.
I tell my staff that, you know, not everybody can have the benefit of having been born in another country, but everybody can learn another language. I speak broken Hmong, a little Somali, and enough Chinese to get myself in trouble most days. But those are skills that I think are not nice to haves anymore in public safety. They're have to haves. Right? When a firefighter goes in a house and is in a Somali community and is trying to evacuate people, not being able to speak to them in their language to say there's a fire, come this way, is a matter of life and death. When the dispatcher who runs the ECCN can't communicate with the dispatcher, and I know we can get Google Translator, but there's a lag and there's not that momentary contact between person to person. And frankly, when a DVS driver's license instructor is trying to make sure that the 16-year-old from Greater Minnesota that was born in Mexico and is now living here can take their driver's test, I want them all to feel like this is their DPS and that we are going to serve them all.
I want to bring in Teresa in St. Cloud. She's listening to the conversation with our new Public Safety Commissioner, John Harrington. Hi, Teresa. You have a question?
I do. Congratulations, Commissioner. What can we do to help with the growing problem of police and firefighter suicide? I'm just really sad for all of the news that PTSD and depression is hitting our public safety officers so hard.
Teresa, I appreciate the question, and it's an important question. I came out of transit where we had been employing the 21st century policing model, and the pillar six of that spoke to that issue of both officer safety and officer wellness. And we're going to expand that to think in terms of both firefighters and police and all first responders. We need to make sure that there is not a stigma when you've seen too much. And that happens with every first responder. I can remember, I was a young baby cop with St. Paul, and we went to a crib death. And my partner, who had just had a baby at home, could not go in there and process that scene because that child reminded him of the infant that he had left that night to come to work. That scars you. My young cops on transit, when we've had horrible fatal crashes, and they're for the first time out there trying to reconcile, the widow who's standing there who wants to see their loved one, and you're going, you don't want to see what happens when a train runs over somebody. But those images are locked in your mind and on your soul. And I know the firefighters have that same thing. We were looking at the reports this morning. There was a fatal fire in Greater Minnesota where a man could not get out of his trailer. And he was overcome by smoke. But those images stay with you. And so we have to provide a lack of stigma for officers and first responders when that happens. And then we have to recognize that they need help. And that help can come in peer counseling. It can come in professional counseling, but it has to come in a therapeutic mode where there is no stigma in terms of their professional work while they're getting better.
So acknowledging how hard the job is.
Absolutely.
And being open to talking about it. Kirk in Manoman is also listening at this hour. And Kirk, you have a question for Commissioner Harrington?
Yes, I do. I feel we're already quite fortunate in Minnesota, and I'm wondering what will be the increasing and ongoing focus on safety for LGBTA individuals?
Kirk, thanks very much for that question. I believe that, you know, I've worked with Outfront Minnesota. I've worked with several different organizations to try and, A, reduce the street harassment that we see that happen with LGBTQ individuals. And so I expect to expand that work from just the Metro Transit work that we started in that area to really a statewide approach. One of the areas that I especially want to work with is with the Office of Justice Programming. That office provides grants that can both support prevention activities, educational activities, and then resources for organizations to help with individuals who have been harassed or have been battered. And so I want to make sure that when we do have a victim that is LGBTQ, that we are making sure that they get all of the services and all of the proper response. But just as importantly, I want to help to make sure that we're educating the public so that we can prevent these things from happening. That was the gold standard with Sir Robert Peel, was the ultimate mission for the police was to prevent crime and disorder, not simply to respond to it.
We have another caller, Naz, in Roseville, and it sounds like Naz has been following your career. Naz, you have a question for Commissioner Harrington?
Hi, yes, Commissioner Harrington. Thank you for being on this morning, first and foremost. I was wondering, so earlier in the show, you spoke about your experiences multiculturally, how you went to Somalia earlier in your career to better help your residents here. And I'm wondering, there's a lot of politicians that we've seen. There haven't been initiatives for the Somali community, but also since we have the biggest Hmong community outside of Laos, what initiatives and plans that you guys have multiculturally since we live in such a diverse community?
Thank you, Naz. And I should add, too, for our listeners, in 2015, when you were Chief Harrington, you became the first police chief from Minnesota to visit Somalia. And it was at a time when Somali Minnesotans were beginning to join police departments. Tell me about that relationship with Somalia and why you chose to visit there.
The story behind the Somali trip, which was a great adventure, and I've now been back twice, and we managed to get an ambulance to them, and we got them literally almost 2,000 pounds of body armor and police equipment that we were able to get donated from Minnesota chiefs of police and sheriffs to the Somali police force. Really starts with a young man named Waheed Sarach. Waheed was the first Somali officer hired by Metro Transit. And he challenged me when I first got to transit. He said, you know, you talk a good game about diversity. You talk a good game about how you want to be more inclusive. We're going to test you to see if you really are going to do that. And so he brought more Somali officers to the table. About a year or so into that, he had an opportunity to go back to Mogadishu to train the Somali police force. I was a little skeptical. I've had officers who've gone on international trips before, working, you know, as a support in hostile countries, and some of them didn't come back. So I was very skeptical and very nervous about it. But he convinced me that this was an appropriate mission if you really wanted to make Minnesota safe. The connection between Minnesota and Mogadishu is direct.
So what is the connection? How do Minnesotans benefit from you visiting Somalia and learning about the culture there or training officers there?
Combination. We now have a much better understanding and a much better relationship with the Somali police force. There were cases where we had individuals here in Minnesota that committed crimes, homicides, and what would happen is, often as not, is they would flee back to Mogadishu, which didn't have a civil government at the time. Now they have a civil government. Now they have a Somali police force. Bashir is the commissioner of police there. We now have a relationship so that when we need to find somebody who's committed a heinous act here, they're helping us. The other piece of this is we also now have a much better understanding of the whole nexus on how does someone get radicalized. They have to deal with this every day. We deal with it occasionally, but as the home of the second biggest population of Somalis in the world, it would be irresponsible if we did not take note of the lessons that they had already learned about how do you prevent radicalization? How do you, what are the early signs of this? How do you intervene in that so that you don't have terrorist activities in the homeland. So this was a win-win in that regard. And then the other piece of this was simply a matter of the Somali community here loves their current home, but they also have a great deal of fondness for where they came from. And they felt like they didn't feel like it was safe enough for them to go back. My going there and working to help make the Somali capital a safe place, I think gives Minnesotans of Somali birth an opportunity to go back home to see their family and see their kids and see their grandparents and to visit their homeland with a greater sense that they are secure and they're safe because we are equipping the Somali police force to do an even better job.
I need to ask you about being a state senator. So you already know a lot of folks at the Capitol because you served in the state Senate from 2010 to 2012, representing the east side of St. Paul. But just one term? What? Just
definitely
just that was enough?
Just one term.
Tell us about it.
So there's two. I was recruited to run for the seat that Mimua had absented. And it was a great learning experience to be able to serve my community, to try and advocate on behalf of the East Side, which is this an incredibly diverse mosaic of communities. It's really the epicenter for the Latino community. It's the home of the Hmong community with the Hmong Shopping Center over there. It has a huge Somali community. It has a great Black community. And it has the traditional Irish and German and Scandinavian and Italian communities. Smushed together into the East Side. But one of the things that I understood almost immediately there is that there is a disconnect between the legislative, which is a deliberative body, and the how do we get things done body, which is the executive function. And I had spent most of my career where you identify a problem for me, I come up with a solution for the problem, and we start tomorrow to fix the problem. With the deliberative body, what I discovered was you discuss the problem, and then you discuss the problem with some other people, and then hopefully you get a bill that you can get onto the floor, and then it has to then pass there, and then you have to convince the folks in the House that they think it's a problem too, and then you have to convince the governor that it's a problem, and then now I have to convince a commissioner that it's a problem. And there was too big a disconnect from the constituents who were saying, we need employment, we need jobs on the East Side, we need public safety on the East Side, and the ultimate implementation at the other end. And so a lot of my friends saw that I was frustrated with the gap between start to finish. And they said, you were more of an executive branch kind of guy by personality.
So it was not a good fit for you.
It wasn't a good fit for me. I got all my bills passed. I had great friends in both sides of the legislature, but there was that lag between my seeing the problem and then actually seeing the solutions implemented, which makes this a much better fit for me. The legislature will deliberate, and then I am ready to hit this ground running and get started on solving the problems.
But looking back now, can you see the value of that? Because now, you know, you'll be working with state legislators and trying to, you know, convince them of policies that you think are important. You've sat in those seats, so you know what their world is like.
I know what their role is. I know what and I have relationships with them. And I think that's, you know, probably as much as anything else, that's what community policing taught me before. And it continues to teach me that the gold standard for being a good public safety or being a good government official is built on relationships. And the relationships I had in the Senate and the relationships I had in the House are still paying dividends today as I continue to try and move a public safety agenda through the legislative branch and back through out onto the streets.
I want to bring in one of our listeners. Brian in Minneapolis is on the line and has a question for you, Commissioner Harrington. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you. And congratulations on your new position, Commissioner Harrington. My question is about issues of police brutality and excessive use of force. Oftentimes, the public debate around these becomes, is this an issue of a few bad apples or are there systemic problems? And when I see stories like what we saw the other day in Richfield, where there was an issue of an officer slapping somebody, the police department had fired him, but then a judge ruled against that and reinstated them. I feel like there's definitely systemic obstacles for getting at this problem. So my question is, in your new role, how can your department help make sure that we're addressing the systemic problems and making sure that all of our communities, especially in this case, the Black community, feel like their concerns and needs are being responded to?
Brian, I appreciate the question. And one of the first things I did when I got into the office was to actually call my colleagues, Rondo and Todd, to have conversation about what could the Department of Public Safety, how could we act as a convener or a facilitator to have a better conversation about how do we hold police officers accountable?
You taught your friends, the St. Paul and the Minneapolis Paul Police Chiefs.
Chief, yes. Yeah, so there were colleagues and friends, and so I was able to simply pick up the phone, call them and say, I'd like to have a conversation about this. I'd also like to have a conversation, for example, and have had conversations with John Choi, Mike Freeman, the Ramsey County Attorney, Hennepin County Attorneys. Mm-hmm. I've talked to Pete Orpitt out of Washington County and what I ultimately want to do is I want to convene the major police chiefs together to have a conversation about how can the state assist them in making sure that officers are held accountable and to support them in implementing the 21st century policing model, which really speaks to that issue of building trusting relationships between communities of color and their police department, making sure that police officers, when they do stray, are held accountable, and making sure that we have good mechanisms for being able to judge those activities.
And we should remind our listeners that as the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA, falls under your supervision. BCA has been in the news a lot in the public eye in the last few years for taking over investigations for officer-involved shootings in which Black men were shot and killed by officers. BCA investigated the shooting death of Jamar Clark. BCA investigated the shooting death of Philando Castile. And also there were cases of mentally ill people who were shot and killed by police. It trickles up. Goes back up to you.
Ultimately, I'm the responsible party to make sure that the BCA is doing all that they can. And frankly, part of that 21st century policing model is really to speak to this issue of transparency. How can the BCA, the local police department, the local county attorney, those elected officials and appointed officials work in a transparent fashion so that we create a trusting relationship that says what we're going to produce is a trusted document of what the facts are, that we are not, we have no animus in this. We are simply the seekers of truth. We are looking for the facts so that a county attorney or another legislative or judicial level can, in fact, make a good judgment as to was this use of force lawful. But we also want to be able there, the BCA and others help work on training for officers. And so I look at this as how can we prevent this from happening? Are there mechanisms that we can facilitate in terms of training, de-escalation training, less than lethal? I saw Chief Axtell the other day initiated a new less than lethal approach that his officers are going to use. How can the BCA, how can the state assist not just St. Paul, not just Minneapolis, but the entire state of Minnesota to try and see what best practices are?
Now, BCA often gets called in to help investigate in rural counties where, you know, more expertise might be needed. So you were telling me that now anytime anything terrible happens across the state, you have to keep an eye on it because, you know, this is part of something that is now under your supervision.
The 2 o'clock feedings that I used to get when I was the St. Paul chief, it's every night in St. Paul, something interesting happens, whether it's a shooting or a fire or right. crash. And so you got used to being awakened in the middle of the night with these, you know, what happened in St. Paul that mm-hmm. you needed to know about. And now the 2 o'clock feedings are broader. So I, you know, when the officer-involved shooting happened in Duluth, I hear about that when I just heard on your news feed the issue of the human remains being found in a fire pit. I now hear about that because BCA is assisting on the investigations. When there is a major drug bust in the state of Minnesota where we're breaking up a meth lab, the BCA is involved in that. And commensurately so. I also know we get to hear about all of the crashes. So when the blizzards hit the last few days, we heard about all of the cars that were stuck and all of the different crashes and the heroic work by the Minnesota men and women of the Minnesota State Patrol that were out there in just completely whiteout conditions, still serving, still getting people out of the ditch, still getting those tractor trailers off of the freeway in just completely hazardous conditions. So we have all of those things together.
All right. I want to bring in more of our listeners to the conversation. Joe in Woodbury has been holding on patiently. Hi, Joe. You have a question?
Yes, I do. It's kind of three questions. I've been very pleased with hearing some words from you, Commissioner, about prevention. And in my background in 40 years in the healthcare arena, it's taken us a long time to really put some big money and shift the attitudes from treating symptoms of disease or treating disease to prevention. And is there are we spending enough money on crime prevention? And that's one part of it. The other is one of the things that has made such a difference in medicine so that patients know no matter what hospital they go to, if they come in with a heart attack, they're going to be treated the same because we have science that says if you do A, B, C, D, E, you're going to get the best outcome. So are you using science and research to build the infrastructure, your policy, your procedures, you know, throughout the different branches of law enforcement so that we know if someone's going to respond in Pelican Rapids or if they're going to respond in Minneapolis, a lot of that's going to be the same.
Okay, Joe, let's let the commissioner jump in here. So she's asking about crime prevention, getting ahead of the problems.
And I want to say, do I think that we're spending enough money on prevention activities? No. I will be perfectly frank that I think that there's an opportunity there. And Governor Walz is leading us in the right direction with that. So the discussion, for example, on opioid abuse, which has been a law enforcement issue and a health issue, is really being held through the health department because it is a health issue first and foremost, and then law enforcement will have its role there. We're having the same conversations, for example, on some of the domestic violence cases. Are there ways to deal with domestic violence cases where we're looking at them kind of in an epidemiological sense of how do we triage these cases so that we can get out ahead of them? So I don't think we're spending as much money, but we are starting to shift our focus from reactive policing, which is we clean up the mess after the bad thing happens, to trying to get out to intervention and prevention mode. In terms of unifying police procedures, that really speaks to the POST Board, Minnesota Police Officer Standards and Training Board. There's also a Firefighters Board, which comes under my jurisdiction. And there, I think we are doing more and more so that no matter what city you're in, the officer that is going to respond to your call has been taught about procedural justice. They've been taught about implicit bias. They've been taught about de-escalation skills so they can take someone who's got a mental health challenge and ramp this down so that nobody has to get hurt. Are you ever going to get a absolutely universal response? I don't know. I don't know that that's true in medicine or in policing. The individual circumstances have to come into play. The last thing I will say, though, is that, yes, one of the challenges that Governor Walz has given us is to say he wants to lead with facts first rather than anecdotes. And so what we have started doing, whether it's MNLARS, domestic violence, working with victims of crime, is to try and see what are the national best practices and to make sure that Minnesota departments, in whatever fashion, are working with the best information they possibly can so that we are using the information and the guidance of wise people and good research people from across the world.
All right. We also want to bring in Andrew in Duluth, who is listening and wants to join the conversation. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, and congratulations on the new position, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I'm an emergency telecommunicator, and I just wanted to ask if there's any interest in increasing recognition of the work that telecommunicators do. I know right now, federally, we're classified essentially the same as clerks or secretaries as a support staff. But with the advance in technology in the dispatch area, we're taking more than we ever have before, and soon possibly video. So not only will we have to deal with a lot of the traumatic situations that we deal with on the phone, but we may even actually have to be seeing much of the stuff that the responders in the field do. Is there any interest on the state level into looking at maybe recognizing dispatchers as the first responders?
I can't say that I've had that conversation yet. I appreciate the conversation, having served three times in the Emergency Communication Center in St. Paul Police during my career there. So I what you're saying resonates with me because that dispatcher who's got that they're the lifeline between the person who's calling in crisis and the police department or the fire department or the EMS folks who are going to ultimately respond. I know with St. Paul, when we merged our comm centers, the train up to make sure that all of the dispatchers understood emergency medical protocols. And also now there really is an issue of knowing mental health protocols and how do we work with those folks. I've never viewed dispatchers and, TCCs and emergency comm center folks as anything other than trained police professionals. And so you can expect out of my office that we will treat them statewide as the trained police professionals or public safety professionals, more broadly spoken, that they really are. I cannot imagine anyone looking at a person that's the lifeline between their community and the government as being anything less than that.
So, Commissioner, you have, I want to talk about education for a minute. You're a student and a teacher. You have a master's degree in education from St. Thomas, but for years you've been teaching at Metro State University, the University of St. Thomas, and St. Mary's University. And the classes, I read that you teach classes in leadership, policing, as well as gangs, demographics. What do you enjoy about teaching college students?
It keeps me young.
I thought Menlars kept you young.
Menlars keeps me awake. Menlars is making sure that my coffee consumption is not going to go down. Young, I'm not sure that that's the same thing. No, I mean, I sat last night and with a group of students from St. Mary's as we're talking about 21st century policing, and the assistant chief from Minneapolis, Jose, was there, and we're having this really robust conversation, which takes it from the academic theory of how do you build trust? What happens when that trust is broken? He talked about his experience as the 4th Precinct Commander, at different times in his career, and how do you work with a community? And he was able to then translate that theory into reality. And you can see the light bulb go on as the students work through that. But I also learn a ton from my students. So every year when I have my students do presentations. So this year, for example, they're going to present on the topic of how should a police department bridge the trust gap between a variety of different groups. Black community, Asian community, Somali community, women, domestic violence survivors. And what's amazing to me is as much as I think I've been doing this for 40 years, I've heard it all, I've seen it all, inevitably they come up with a new wrinkle, a new idea, a new way to approach this. And for me, those are some aha moments. I think I can use that. Mm-hmm. I can translate that into this. So a lot of the good ideas that you've seen me implement over the years are frankly ideas that first happened in the classroom where my students talked about what should we be doing with the homeless community? And that turned into the homeless action team at Transit as we began to say, it's not enough to just talk about it. Once again, for me, this is all about the action. How can you actually get boots on the ground and get first responders and get people out there to start really helping with those that are most in need?
That just reminds me, my colleague Nina Morney did an excellent story, and she interviewed you about the number of homeless people who are riding the trains as a safe place. And what are your thoughts about our homeless problem here throughout the Twin Cities?
It's really a function of we don't have enough housing. But we also have, it's also a function of that we have not really, as a community, as a society, dealt with those who have significant mental health and substance abuse problems. So just to blame it on the housing people is, I think, would not be a genuine statement. The housing folks have their role in this, and I think we definitely need more housing. But I watch what Tim Marks is doing, what the Union Gospel Mission is doing. I see them doing great things, building Salvation Army. There's great things happening there. But we as a community have to recognize that we're going to help people that have significant mental health challenges, who have a background of using substances to self-medicate, and we have to help them get well so that they can rejoin the community as fully fledged participants.
We have a listener, another listener named Joe. Joe, is in St. Paul. Joe, you have a question for Commissioner Harrington?
Yes. First, I want to say how glad I am that you've been appointed as commissioner. I remember you when you were working with youth, and we attended a hearing. I happened to be at a hearing where you were on youth in trouble. And the reason I was attending the hearing is that I was having trouble with my teenage son, who had gotten involved with drugs, started out with marijuana. And I was having a lot of trouble, and it ended in the tragedy. But what I want to ask is, what can we do to prevent children from having access to first marijuana and then other drugs? I mean, they're getting them in the schools. I talked to several principals who said, and children who said, there was a problem, this is a number of years ago, with kids smoking marijuana in the bathrooms, and the teachers, there was not enough staff to monitor it. I worked in public health for a number of years, once on an addiction study, and I think we really have to spend more time and money on prevention and figuring out how these things happen. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Thank you, Joe, for your question.
And Joe, I'm sorry to hear that your case with your son or daughter ended in a tragedy. And that's, you know, I've got seven kids and a bunch of grandkids, and every one of them is precious to me. And so I can only imagine the pain that comes from that. In regards to what do we need to do about it, I will say one of the things that we did about it, and this is sort of a sidebar to my professional life, is we created a program called Ujamaa Place. Ujamaa Place is a program for young, primarily African-American young men who are either coming out of the criminal justice system or coming out of, mostly out of underperforming. We get a lot of referrals from a lot of young men's moms who say, I've done everything I can to help him be a man, and I need somebody else to help me with this. And a lot of our young men come in with substance abuse issues. And what we discovered is that with the right coaching and with a supportive community that surrounds them, that those substance abuse issues can be resolved. But it really does, and to use a very cliched statement, it does really take a circle of influence around them to do that. And so the image I want to paint for you that I think really does work is a parent, a teacher, a drug counselor, a coach, a minister, a police officer, all holding hands around that young person who's in the middle. And we close ranks around that young person. And when we close ranks, even when that young person tips, and they will tip, they will backslide, they'll have good days and bad days just like the rest of us, that young person can't fall down that way. We are there to support them as they continue to move toward sobriety and move toward being a productive and you know, law-abiding citizen. That has worked at Ujamaa Place incredibly well. We've had well over 4,000 young men who come to us oftentimes with all of the disabilities that society can label on a person. And how to think over the course of the last 7 years, we've had seven of them that have returned back to jail. Now, the recidivism rate is incredibly low, and what we're seeing is they're working, they're getting jobs, they're reuniting with their families, they're taking care of their children, they are engaged with their community, and the more they're engaged with their community, the more they're working hard, the further and further away from drug use and drug abuse that they get.
As you move forward in your job, what do you think has best prepared you for it? I mean, you have all the years of being a street cop, you've been an administrator, you've been, you know, you teach, but what do you think is going to help you be successful in this role?
I think being a dad. Actually,
might really?
Be the most important thing that I've done in my life is I've helped raise very good children. I've got all my children are launched. Most all of them actually work for the government. They're all in public service.
I've got grandkids,
and some of them are starting college. But I learned, my father taught me early on that you need to be responsible for your own. Now, how do you define who is your own? Mm-hmm. When I was a young dad, my own were my babies that were at the house that I had to teach how to ride a bike and had to make sure they were provided for. And now my own is a broader. I'm never going to forget my children. They are always close to my heart. But I see the young men and women of our community as my own also. I take responsibility for them. And now I have a bigger family. Whereas it might have been the family of St. Paul, now it's the family of the state of Minnesota. And so the lesson I'm learning and have learned is to be in relationship with the community, because they're my family, they're my support mechanism, and they're who, that's what jazzes me up about getting up in the morning and going on and tackling some new problem, is that I know that they're there waiting for solutions, that they're waiting for help. And they're not just waiting passively. They're ready to roll up their sleeves in true Minnesotan fashion and dive right in with us to make sure that the good things, that the world-class services for Minnesotans are provided.
And you said that what's helping you, too, is you're asking for feedback and you're getting it from the people you're working with, that you're supervising.
I'm getting it from the community because you know me. I like being in community. I learn a ton from those community meetings that I go to all the time. And I'm learning a ton from the firefighters who have come and visited with me already to try and help me understand the experience of what being a firefighter is. The troopers are helping me understand what is it like to work in greater Minnesota and be out there in the middle of the winter and see a car that has plunged into a pond, and you're what saves that person. That's what I'm learning from.
Well, we wish you the best. Our new Commissioner of Public Safety, John Harrington, thank you for your time.
Thank you. You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000. Or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@mpr.org.